Hello, everyone. This is Steve Phelan for People, Places, and Things, readings from the archives of American Heritage Magazine. This week, we're continuing a story we began last week called Light Horse Harry's Tragic Fight for Freedom of the Press. And it's a story about how the father of Robert E. Lee, a famous Revolutionary War hero, protected or defended somebody by the name of Hansen, who had been writing political stories and enraged the populace of Baltimore. And we pick it up here. Hansen temporarily retreated to the town of Georgetown near the national capital and resumed production of the paper, mailing editions to Baltimore. These, though, were captured at the post office and destroyed. Quote, "We shall cling to the rights of free men, both in act and opinion, until we sink with the liberties of our country, or sink alone," he had declared. And indeed, in July, spoiling for a fight, Hansen ended his exile. Sneaking back into Baltimore, he set up shop in a two-story brick dwelling at 45 Charles Street. From there, the Federal Republic resumed its defiance. On June 27th, the day that the newspaper, as he put it, quote, "ascended from the tomb," Hansen took aim at Baltimore's mayor and police for permitting the earlier attack, exposing the paper and its property, quote, "to the fangs of a remorseless rabble." This edition of the paper had actually been printed in Georgetown, but it was distributed in Baltimore. Zealously exercising his constitutional rights, Hansen was begging for a return engagement with the rabble, and he got exactly that. Many of Baltimore's Federalists, who had armed themselves after the original round of riots, viewed Hansen's risky behavior as madness. Accordingly, when Hansen settled into the house on Charles Street, he had to find friends from elsewhere to man his new headquarters. Chief among them was James L. Lingen, a grizzled veteran who had been bayoneted and imprisoned on the notorious British prison ship HMS Jersey during the Revolution. He was later appointed to the collector of Port of Georgetown and commissioned a general. When Hansen had retreated to that town, Lingen gave him shelter. Lingen was a fierce Federalist and an equally staunch champion of a free press. The supporting cast were younger men, Captain Richard I. Crabb, John Howard Payne, Charles Kilgore, Otho Sprigg, these are great first names, Ephraim Gaither, John Thompson, Dr. Peregrine Warfield, Major Musgrove, Henry C. Gaither, and William Gaither. That's a lot of people. One man joined the party on Charles Street, serving as its informal commander-in-chief. Later, he would explain this was merely a business trip to Baltimore, that he had visited the city on matters relating to his memoirs, and called on the house on Charles Street on the evening of the 27th to visit old friends and play a game of whist. But as Hansen assembled a small army to defend his business, he recalled the mythology of the American Revolution. In the dire winter of 1778, a young rebel captain, aided only by a handful of soldiers, had repelled a larger British force from a house in the Pennsylvania countryside. Hansen wanted the hero of that episode to come to his defense. He had invited him for that purpose. Never mind that nearly 40 years had passed since that fabled morning, or that the young revolutionary was now aged and ailing, his youthful lust for battle dissipated. Every indication suggests that Lee went to Baltimore on a military mission, and that he passed over Hansen's threshold, determined to defend the house and the freedoms he had fought to win another war ago. On July 20th, he sent an unsigned letter to Hansen, outlining how the house on Charles Street could be defended. He wanted two men posted at each window, and the stairway just beyond the front door barricaded. A stockpile of stones and logs on the home's upper level should be ready to be dropped on invaders. Quote, should the iniquity of the mob render it proper for you to implement my advice, Lee cautioned, remember, you ought not to provoke their action, and that you ought to require in time the aid of the civil authority, and that you, having begun defense, must never think of concession. Die or conquer. Woo! 60 men, at a minimum, were necessary to defend the home, and they were to approach their mission with military regimentation. Roll call was scheduled for 6 p.m., after which no man was permitted to leave. Lee even wanted a spy ring, with men leaving the house during the day to gain intelligence on the plans and movements of the enemy. As the sun receded and the sky darkened on the evening of the 27th, a crowd began to gather around the house on Charles Street. It consisted of young men, laborers, and sailors, many of them immigrants, and all Democrat-Republicans. Shortly before 8 o'clock p.m., a carriage pulled to a halt before them. From it, muskets were hurried into the house, only peeking the peak of those gathered outside. There's a phrase you won't hear very often, peeking the peak. Some of the crowd milling about scooped up stones and chucked them at the house. Soon, window panes were shattered, sashes and shutters smashed. A member of Hansen's party, Harry Nelson, injured. Now, Hansen showed himself in an upstairs window and addressed the mob. If they would not leave, he explained, they would be repelled by gunfire. Blank shots were fired overhead to prove the point. But this only further angered the already angry men below. There was a rush to bash in the front door, accompanied by screams of death. Lee had stressed that every measure should be taken to avoid the spillage of blood. A plea for protection should be made to the city's authorities. But now he was thrown into a defensive crouch. He sent a sentry up the stairs, facing the now smashed door. In its place, chairs and tables formed a makeshift barricade. A stalemate lasted for 2 hours. Then, at 11 o'clock, the mob, led by an electrician, Dr. Thaddeus Gale, worked up the will to finally push forward into the building. Quote, I will lead you on, and we will kill every damned rascal in that house, he shouted. But as they entered the home, a hail of fire greeted them. Gale was killed, others injured. The mob retreated, firing shots of their own and wounding one of Lee's party, Ephraim Gaither. Men of the attacking mob tore open their shirts, beat their chests, and screamed, "Fire again!" Well, that's a stupid thing to do. There had been no sign of any representative from the city or its police force until, at 10 p.m., Judge John Scott, Chief Justice of Baltimore's Criminal Court, arrived on the scene. A loyal Republican, he did little to subdue the crowd. The responsibility for preventing the violence rested with Brigadier General John Stricker, commander of the Baltimore Brigade of Maryland's Militia. But he dithered in his home, just doors down on Charles Street. Stricker was also a loyal Republican, a merchant, and a banker. He had little interest in dispersing a crowd of politically like-minded citizens in order to save a pack of Federalists. Urged by concerned citizens, he did as little as possible, first ordering two justices of the peace to sign a statement enabling him to intervene, and then, instead of sending in the entire Baltimore Brigade, the 5,000-man militia at his disposal, he sent Major William B. Barney and a selection of men from his small unit to settle the matter with a mob now numbering over 300. This was barely a half measure. Barney was a Republican candidate for the House of Delegates, and like Stricker, had very little political motivation to forcibly remove the mob. When he arrived with 30 of the 90 troops in his unit, he had orders from Stricker not to fire on the crowd. At 3 a.m., Barney moved his men into a line in front of the house, forming a blockade between the attackers and their prey. Soldiers, their swords held aloft, were stationed by the windows. So riled were the throng that Barney was approached by a drunken Irishman who accused him of protecting the Tories and punched him in the chest. Once he managed to enter the house, Barney conferred with Lee and Hansen. There was little he could do, the major explained. He had not been ordered to disperse the crowd. His men did not even have pistols. When he asked for a drink of water, and Lee walked with him to a cupboard to fetch it, Barney pleaded with Lee not to stand near him, lest those outside think they were in league and kill him. Quote, "I know your situation. It is a delicate one. I am sure you are doing all you can," Lee charitably responded. Once again outside, Barney explained to the crowd that he was only there to secure the property and those in it. Many happily assumed this meant he was there to apprehend and jail Hansen and his comrades. But still they lingered, growing impatient, and eventually breaking into a nearby armory and dragging a cannon to the house. The men, however, didn't know how to fire or even aim the weapon. And we think things are bad today. Finally, as the sun began to rise, Baltimore Mayor Edward Johnson and General Stricker appeared on the scene. The former, yet another Republican, had been mayor for 4 years and was in pursuit of a second term in that office. He entered the house and delivered a rebuke to Hansen. His conduct was inviting civil war. But this was his house, and he had every right to defend it, Hansen countered. Ultimately, Johnson and Stricker could not and would not protect the party. The only recourse was to surrender to the city's authorities and be escorted off to jail. There, Stricker promised, they would be safe. Hansen vehemently objected to this proposal. To jail? For what? Protecting my house and property against a mob who assailed both for 3 hours, he cried. Lee inquired why the entire Baltimore Brigade had not been called out. "That is the brigade," said Stricker, pointing to the crowd outside. Lee, many years Hansen's senior, and no longer the quarrelsome young soldier who had beheaded deserters and challenged congressmen to duels, recognized the odds. Supplies were dwindling. There was little food or water left in the house. Only 23 of the defenders remained. The rest had escaped during the night. Every single authority in the city, Jeffersonians all, was predisposed toward the mob. If another confrontation came, the men in the house would have little chance of survival. Surrender was the only chance to end the standoff without further violence. Lee parleyed in the home's parlor with Johnson and Stryker for terms of surrender. Could they be allowed to leave the home bearing their arms, on horseback, surrounded by the militia? This was not permissible, replied Johnson and Stricker. Hansen protested bitterly. The promises of these Democratic Republicans could not be trusted. If they could not dismiss the mob, they could offer no real protection. He repeated over and over that to surrender was to be sacrificed. But eventually, Lee convinced Hansen and the others to submit. He believed that the assurances from Stricker, a fellow veteran of the Revolution, that the party would be protected, were trustworthy. At 9 a.m., the party exited the house, marching a mile to their destination in a protective square formed by militiamen. The home was ransacked shortly after its inhabitants departed. Upon hearing of an unexecuted plot to stone the prisoners to death on the way, Johnson and Stricker ordered a brigade of militia to guard the Baltimore City Jail, a two-story stone structure with no perimeter wall. But these militia would only be furnished with blank cartridges. Rightly fearing that they would be torn to shreds by a bloodthirsty mob, barely 50 soldiers appeared at the militia headquarters on Gay Street. After their hour-long journey to the jail, during which they were pelted with rocks, Lee and the others were crammed into a barely finished room, off a long corridor sided by cells in a section of the building reserved for, quote, "Negroes and rogues." A stout door secured the prisoners, its thick iron bars forming a grate. In the afternoon, both Johnson and Stricker arrived at the jail, along with other city officials, to guarantee the prisoners would be safe. But two leaders of the mob slipped in behind the mayor's party and carefully studied the faces and clothing of the prisoners. As the city leaders left the jail, they encountered a gathering crowd outside. When promises were proffered that no bail would be posted for the prisoners, the gathering seemed to disperse. Satisfied, Stricker rode home, intent on finally catching some sleep. On his way, he dismissed the militia. Lee's trust in a fellow warrior was badly misplaced. He later cursed the, quote, base perfidy of General Stickler's unkept promise of protection. Word that the militia had been recalled filtered back to the jail. The mob, construing this as tacit approval of a massacre, regrouped and stormed the building. When the entrance to the jail would not give, they moved around to an opening on the east side of the building. Now, three doors separated them from their prey. The first they labored to take down for 15 minutes before finally passing through. The second door they bashed open quickly. The mob then entered the corridor in search of Lee and Hansen's cell. Initially, they hit on the wrong room, but a Frenchman inside pointed them toward the right one. Watching the scene unfold through the spaces between the iron bars of their door, the prisoners hurriedly debated a course of action. Armed only with a handful of pistols and daggers, they wouldn't be able to fight off the mob. Lee suggested they use the pistols to kill themselves, sparing themselves from the coming torture and depriving their would-be murderers of the pleasure. John Thompson, one of the youngest and strongest of the prisoners, welcomed the fight. As the mob searched for the cell, he shouted, "You are at the wrong door! We are in here!" When they arrived at the right door, they opened it with its key, likely procured by the butcher, Mumua, one of the men who had scoped out the prisoners when Johnson and Stricker visited the jail. At that point, young Thompson, along with Daniel Murray, burst out, pistols pointed forward, warning, "My lads, you had better retire. We shall shoot some of you." Members of the mob replied, "How will you do it? You can't kill all of us." Then, in an instant, Thompson and Murray sprang forward, extinguishing the torches of their unwanted visitors and sprinting toward the jail's front door. In the ensuing darkness and confusion, the prisoners proceeded out the door of their room, rushing for safety. Thompson was the first to pass the door, but as he exited, he was bashed on the head and tumbled 12 feet down the stairs leading out of the jail. Surrounded, he begged for his life, only to be tarred and feathered and put in a cart and wheeled away, his face slashed with rusty swords. John Hall and George Winchester were also beaten on their way to freedom. In minutes, the jail's floor had turned red with blood. As Hansen made his dash for the door, Mumua recognized the arch-Federalist, knocked him senseless, and tossed his limp body down the stairs. When the crowd beat the crusty old Lingon, he chided his attackers. He had fought for their freedom, after all. In his last moments, he ripped off his clothing, exposing the scars he still carried from the war. Where had his attackers been during the Revolution? In France, or among the bogs of Ireland? As he was bludgeoned to death, a member of the mob declared that, quote, "The damned old rascal is the hardest dying of them all." This was not technically true. As Lee made his way from his cell, he was apprehended, his head pummeled with clubs and his body hurled outside, bounding down the steps before finally coming to rest atop the shoulders of a John Hall. The bodies of others were quickly piled on top of these two, forming a macabre monument to the throng's bloodlust. Lying on the ground, unable to move, Lee quietly groaned. This only excited the crowd. As more men arrived, he was singled out as, quote, "that damned old Tory." One of them snorted, "He died true game, huzzaing for King George to the last." seemingly unaware that the mob's victim had long ago helped pry that monarch's grip off America. An assailant approached Lee's wounded body, drew back his blade, and began to slice off his nose. Unable to sever the whole thing, he left Lee with a gaping gash in the middle of his face. Now another knife was thrust at his eye. Just as it reached his face, Lee sat up, blocking the blow, which instead ripped through his cheek and covered his weathered old face in blood. He collapsed, his head falling on the prostrate Hansen's breast. He was promptly kicked off, leaving a crimson blotch on the younger man's chest. "See Hansen's brains on his breast," enthused one of the monsters, mistaking Lee's blood for Hansen's. To measure if any life remained, Lee's eyelids were peeled open, and scalding candle wax dripped over his pupils. Lingen was dead, Lee seemingly so. Others, such as Hansen, feigned death. As he lay still, a member of the throng booted him, square in the genitals. There were women present, too. They chortled at the violence, crying, "Kill the Tories!" The scene only grew more ghoulish. Children clapped and skipped, and all present joined hands, dancing around the heap of writhing bodies, singing, "We'll feather and tar every damn British Tory, and this is the way for American glory." Tributes to Madison and Jefferson followed. Then came the exciting matter of disposing of the bodies. One voice suggested dumping them in the jail sink. Another suggested tar and feathers. Another advocated for dissection. A mass hanging was proposed. While the debate went on, Richard Page, the prison's primary physician, alerted to the chaos, arrived. Though a Democratic Republican, he was appalled by the carnage. He appealed to the mob, worn out from their evening of gory mischief, to go home and leave the bodies under his care. After all, he reasoned, most were dead, and the rest soon would be. Satisfied, they merrily moved on. As Page spirited the prisoners back to their jail cell, one spectator asked where they were being taken, to which another responded, "To hell!" With the assistance of the jail's other resident physicians, Page cared for the survivors, dressed their wounds, and provided brandy. An attempt was even made to sew the detached flesh of Lee's nose back into alignment. The doctor then plotted to remove the wounded from the jail. Carriages were called for. Hansen snuck off and away from the city. Others were conveyed into the country in carts covered in hay. Lee's mutilated body was slipped off to the city hospital, where the doctors did what they could to ease his agony. The following morning, he was taken to the home of a Federalist, safely away from Baltimore, in York, Pennsylvania. There he lay motionless and speechless, attended by a duo of doctors. His head, crushed with clubs, had swollen and turned black. His face was sliced like a roast. A blood-stained flannel shirt covered his body. The rest of his clothes were ripped to shreds, and similarly stained from head to toe. There appeared to be a hole where once one of his eyes had been. When James C. Boyd came to see what was left of Lee, he observed that, quote, "When he attempts to stir, he tottered like an infant just commencing to walk." National newspapers reported his demise. "Two great men and heroes have fallen in Maryland. Generals Lingen and Lee are no more. Their spirits have ascended on high," exclaimed the Maryland Gazette. In Washington, D.C., the National Intelligencer reported that the mob had dangerously wounded several, of whom one, General Henry Lee of Virginia, has since died of his wounds. In the partisan press, the past three decades of trouble were sheared away. The notorious business dealings, the humiliating stint in debtor's prison, all forgotten. In death, Lee and Lingen were Federalist martyrs, convenient symbols of Republican savagery. The Baltimore riots were described as, quote, "a scene that has never been paralleled since the days of Robespierre." Lee was remembered in glorious terms as the celebrated orator who, selected by the united voice of his country, delivered the funeral oration over the body of the great, the illustrious Washington. His final moments, according to the Evening Post from New York, were nobly spent, quote, invoking the spirit of Washington, his friend and companion in arms. Federalists gleefully pointed to the grotesque sacrifice of the two old war heroes, Lee and Lincoln. Indeed, in coming to Hanson's side, Lee had defended the very rights for which he had fought during the Revolution, and had paid dearly for it. He was no wild partisan. He had come to defend Hanson's right to exercise his views, not to endorse them. He opposed this new war, but he would have fought in it had he been called to. It was another cruel twist in a luckless life. Only Lee was not dead. The papers were wrong. Confusion spread. From Stratford Hall, Henry Lee IV wrote to William Williams, the son of one of his father's old brothers in arms, Otho Holland Williams. He did not know whether his father still lived, he said, and he had only heard rumors. What was true? He begged Williams, a Baltimore resident, to do all in his power to save Lee's life. This was not necessary. A week after the attack, Lee began to speak again, though with difficulty. His family received word that Lee had survived. "My father was much hurt," Lucy Lee Carter wept to her aunt, Alice Lee Shippen, informing her of the tragedy in August. "Yes, I have heard of the sad catastrophe of Baltimore." Alice responded a month later from Philadelphia, quote, "How melancholy to write or think of it. It is pleasant to report that the worst is over and he is out of danger." Following weeks of recuperation, Lee was well enough to return to Alexandria in early October. But though he had survived the Baltimore mob, he would never recover from their beating. Lee is recalled by history for his valor during the Revolution and for eulogizing George Washington as, quote, "first in war, first in peace, and first in the hearts of his countrymen." Between and after those summits were valleys of considerable death. The loss of his first wife, Matilda Lee, bankruptcy, and a spell in debtor's prison. His health wrecked by the beating in Baltimore, Lee's last years were spent hobbling around Alexandria, Virginia, his disfigured face covered in bandages. The one-time hero was transformed into a frightening apparition. His final years spent wandering the West Indies, he died in destitution off the coast of Georgia in 1818. The Baltimore riot, grisly as it was, is a significant part of Lee's legacy. He sacrificed his health and ultimately his life for Hanson's newspaper, for the right of Americans to criticize their leaders, and for the freedom of the press. Lee shot to fame, fighting to guarantee those rights during the Revolution. Fittingly, his last great public act, the one that sped his demise, was defending them in Baltimore. All right, we're going to start a new article, one that we shall not be able to finish this week, but we'll get to it next week. And here it is, Remembering Neil Armstrong. The first man to set foot on the moon 50 years ago this summer is remembered by his friend and colleague, a former astronaut and administrator of NASA or NASA. This is by Richard Truly in Last Summer. As long as there are history books, Neil Armstrong will be in them. In May of 1961, President John F. Kennedy had committed the nation to, quote, "achieving the goal, before the decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to Earth." A little over 8 years later, on July 20th, 1969, Neil Armstrong commanded the Apollo 11 mission that ultimately ended the Soviet-American space race and met America's goal with more than 5 months to spare. Quote, "Roger, Tranquility," Capcom Charlie Duke in Mission Control replied. "We copy you on the ground. You've got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. We're breathing again. Thanks a lot." The same could be said for hundreds of millions of people around the world watching on black and white television. Armstrong, with Colonel Edwin E. Buzz Aldrin at his side, steered their lunar landing craft, Eagle, to a lunar plain close to the southwestern shore of the Sea of Tranquility. With the world watching, onboard computer alarms sounding, and the fuel extremely low and getting lower, Armstrong was in his element. He skimmed over large boulders covering the planned landing site and softly touched down. His words to Houston were as historic as his deed. "Houston, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed." About 6.5 hours after landing, with a television camera watching every step, Armstrong climbed down Eagle's ladder and set his feet in the lunar dust and said, quote, "That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind." The moonwalk lasted 2 hours and 19 minutes, long enough to let Armstrong and Aldrin test their footing and set up an American flag, a television camera, and scientific instruments to collect rock samples. Apollo 11 left a plaque on the moon, attached to the Eagle's ladder leg, which Armstrong read aloud. Quote, "Here, men from the planet Earth first set foot upon the moon, July 1969 A.D. We came in peace for all mankind." And I think we're going to end it there. We will pick up with the rest of that story next week, but for the moment, this is Steve Phelan for People, Places, and Things.